Good day. Today is Saturday, 1st November 2025, and before I proceed with the details of the video, the substance of the video, let me again just remind you to tick the like button if, once you've watched the video or that part of the video which you want to watch, you like what you have heard and you want to indicate that fact. With that, let me now proceed with the rest of the video. And I would just, before I get into the details of what I will principally talk about today, which is first the situation around Venezuela and then the situation around Ukraine, I will say briefly that the last week, the week that has just passed, has been, in my opinion, a pivotal moment in the foreign policy of the Trump administration. A week which, I think one could perhaps legitimately describe it as disastrous. Firstly, the Russians have been goaded into providing details about what really took place in the discussions between Putin and Witkoff and Putin and Trump in August, during Witkoff's visit to Moscow and during Putin's summit meeting with Trump in Alaska. And as I've discussed now in several programs, that was profoundly different from what we are reading today in the Financial Times, in the rest of the Western media. What is absolutely clear now is that Trump and Witkoff made an offer to the Russians, which in Alaska, Putin accepted, an offer which appears to have been essentially the same as Istanbul Plus, but with some territorial modifications. And then instead of moving forward with that agreement, and I think agreement is not too strong a word to describe what took place in Alaska, Donald Trump, the President of the United States, went back on it, has spread all sorts of false stories about what took place between himself and Trump in Alaska, has threatened the Russians, has made further demands on them, has in effect reversed his position entirely without, of course, providing the Russians with any genuine explanation and stringing them along for months and then making a proposal for a summit meeting in Budapest, which he then walked back on at precisely the moment when it looked as if the Russians might be prepared to agree. There's been a comment about this from the Russians today, addressing specifically articles which have been appearing in the Financial Times, which I have touched on in recent programmes. The previous article, which appeared some weeks ago in the Financial Times, which said that Trump almost walked out of the meeting in Alaska because he was given a boring lecture by Putin about the history of the conflict in Ukraine. No such thing happened. As I have said previously, we know from the Russians that what actually took place in Alaska is that Putin first went through Trump's offer and then told Trump that he had accepted it. So there was that ultimately entirely false article which appeared in the Financial Times. And it has now been followed up by a further equally false article, which has appeared in the Financial Times, which claims that the Trump administration cancelled the summit meeting in Budapest because they received a memorandum from the Russians in which the Russians supposedly set out maximalist demands, and that this hardline memorandum, or allegedly hardline memorandum from the Russians was then followed by a supposedly tense conversation between the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, which also persuaded the Americans to call off the summit meeting. We now have this article in TASS, which addresses these very points. And the article reads as follows: Ukraine-themed contacts between Russia and the United States have not been interrupted, and Moscow has not deviated from the understandings reached during the Alaska summit, a diplomatic source in Moscow has told TASS. In other words, someone very senior in the Russian Foreign Ministry. It could be Lavrov himself. The source said that lately, paid-up reports started to emerge in the media sphere containing variations of the idea that Russian-US contacts have hampered the process of preparations of the Russia-US summit and in general delayed a solution to the Ukrainian crisis. Let me be clear. The Russian side maintains a regular contact with the Americans on the subject of Ukraine settlement. The contacts have not ceased. At the same time, it should be noted that neither before the October 20th phone call between Lavrov and Rubio, nor after this conversation, did the Russian side go beyond the understandings reached by the Russian and US leaders during their detailed exchange of opinions on the Ukrainian crisis during the Alaska summit. And then the article, just to make it completely clear what this is talking about, says that earlier the Financial Times reported that the United States had allegedly cancelled a planned summit in Budapest after Moscow sent a memorandum on Ukraine. The Financial Times further alleged that the conversation between Lavrov and Rubio regarding the summit's preparation was tense. So the Russians are saying in this way that these articles in the Financial Times are untrue, that they are false, that nothing like that happened. And as we've seen, Lavrov has already provided a clear explanation of what really took place. Now, to repeat again, for the moment, the Russians are exercising a measure of restraint here. They presumably are still hoping or expecting that Trump will change his stance, or at least somebody in Moscow is expecting that the administration will change its stance. So they don't want to call Trump and Rubio and whoever it is who is providing all of this information to the Financial Times, which is clearly sources within the United States government. Notice the careful use of the word paid up articles. In other words, articles that have been clearly planted in the Financial Times by US officials. They're still pulling their punches. The Russians are still pulling their punches to a certain extent. But there is no guarantee that they will always do so. And as I have also previously pointed out, other world leaders, Narendra Modi, Xi Jinping, President Lula of Brazil, MBS in Saudi Arabia, were fully briefed by the Russians, by Putin himself, in August about what actually took place in Alaska, and they therefore also know the truth. The Russians also will have an official record of the meetings between Putin and Witkoff in Moscow. Quite probably a recording of that discussion exists. The Russians often record discussions, and I know that for a fact, and the Kremlin does this routinely. And it is highly likely, that is a certainty, that the stenographic record that the Russians also possess of the actual meeting in Alaska will have been agreed by the American and Russian interpreters and is therefore an official record. It is not fully beyond the realms of the possible that if the Americans continue this practice of lying about what took place at that summit meeting or about what has happened over the last few months between the Russia and America, or if the Americans are unwise enough to start making these allegations, these false claims in public, rather than by planting anonymously sourced articles in the Financial Times, then the Russians also will stop being as measured as they have been. They will stop pulling their punches about this affair. And they will start to publish both the stenographic record and their own records of their meetings in Moscow with Witkoff. And then, of course, the world will be able to see, all governments will be able to see, the media, even in the West, will be able to see, even if they don't want to report it, what really took place in Alaska. What Trump and Putin actually said to each other and what was really actually discussed in Moscow in August between Putin and Witkoff. I am not saying that this is what the Russians want to do or are threatening to do, but it does seem to me that what has happened between America and Russia over the last few months is already very bad. It has massively damaged trust between the governments of these countries and the Americans by continuing to plant these false stories in the media about the actual events are walking on increasingly thin ice. Anyway, Alaska, the telephone calls between Putin and Trump, all of that was bad enough. But we've also had the debacle in South Korea, the meeting between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, the Americans trying to put the Chinese in a corner, only to crumble when the Chinese began to take countermeasures, and faced by increasing chip shortages and by threats from China to start restricting exports of rare earths, the United States cancelled all the various aggressive measures that it has taken against China over the last few weeks and finds itself both humiliated, and in Asia, people know that it has been humiliated, and in an extremely difficult overall position relative to China as well. I would add that the Chinese, over the last few hours, have been again making their position clear. They've announced that Western companies that are facing chip shortages because of the Nexpedia affair should contact the Chinese Commerce Ministry. Some people are seeing this as China relaxing its embargo on its blockade of chips that Nexpedia used to provide to say American automobile, American and European automobile workers. I would say, on the contrary, that it is the Chinese telling the European car makers and the American car makers, forget about discussing all of this with your own governments. Talk to us directly about this. We are the ones that decide your future. It is with us that you can get results. We are a more important government for you to speak to than your own. It is, in other words, a further demonstration of power. And on the question of America being able to gain control, to establish equality with China on rare earths and refining rare earths. Well, I've just read a long article about Japan's attempts to do the same thing. These have been underway for 15 years. It's clear that Japan has made some progress in that time, but it has only been able to reduce its dependence on China for rare earths in those 15 years from 90% to 60%. And even that 60%, drilling through what the article says, must be qualified, because though the article didn't make this fully clear, it seems that there is still a certain level of input, Chinese input, even in the 40% where Japan is claiming that it has obtained some degree of technological or rare earths, if you like, independence from China. Now, obviously, the Americans can capitalize on what Japan has done, but it is clear that whatever optimistic expectations there are in the United States and elsewhere of ridding dependence on China for rare earths, there is an awful lot to do, and that the road ahead is going to be stony and hard. Just saying. And this at a particularly difficult moment in economic conditions in the United States, where apparently the relevant companies face all kinds of difficulties, difficulties with financing and with profits, and where, by the way, there are now accumulating reports in the United States that there has been a collapse in consumer confidence, that buying in stores in the United States has fallen off a cliff, with some indications, again, further indications, that the long feared and long anticipated recession in the United States might indeed now perhaps be already underway, or perhaps it's just over the horizon. Anyway, there we are. Now, I'm going to say it further, that insofar as that there has been a one-year truce between China and the United States on trade issues, it appears to me, at least, judged on all recent experience, that it will be China that will put that year's truce to better use than the United States. At least the United States, under this particular administration, which seems chaotically disorganized in the way in which it conducts pretty much everything. Last but not least, I would say that we have further information about renewed Chinese-Russian contacts. I said in my program yesterday that it has now been confirmed that the Russian Prime Minister, Mikhail Mishustin, is heading to Beijing. He's going to be there, to China rather. He's going to be in China on the 3rd of November. He is intending to meet with senior officials in the Chinese government, including China's Prime Minister, and he will eventually have a meeting with Xi Jinping himself. Today, the Russian government confirmed that the Russian Deputy Prime Minister in overall charge of the economy, Denis Manturov, has already arrived in China and will be having further meetings with senior officials of the Chinese government. So it looks as if the Chinese and the Russians, far from being prized apart, are coming closer together. Some of these were scheduled meetings, but I'm starting to get the sense that the meetings have been upgraded in light of recent events. And well, all the indications are that Putin's visit to India in December is still on. And again, as I discussed in my program yesterday, India continues, despite reports to the contrary, to buy Russian oil. There's been confirmation from Reuters that India has made further big oil purchases from Russia for December, which is an important month because the sanctions on Lukoil and Gunvor that the United States has announced come into effect before December on the 21st of November. So all the pieces continue to move, and they continue to move in a way that underlines the reality that the foreign policy of the Trump administration experienced a debacle last week. And moreover, just to say, I've now received a private email which suggests that the real tariff that China is paying, once all the carve-outs and exemptions and exceptions are factored in, it is not 47%, which is the figure that is widely reported, but closer to 20% overall, which would mean that the dial on tariffs against China since the start of the year has barely moved. Anyway, there we go. That's what I wanted to say. Now, let me also now move on and discuss briefly, I say relatively briefly, the situation with Venezuela. Now, yesterday there was a lot of speculations in the media that an attack upon Venezuela was about to happen. President Trump then appeared to deny the fact, and overnight no attack actually took place. But there is now a drumbeat across the American media which says that a order to conduct strikes against Venezuela has already been given. Probably, possibly, this would take place when the USS Carrier the Gerald Ford arrives in the Caribbean. There have been, I wouldn't say demands, support for US military action against the Maduro government from Maria Corina Machado, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who is clearly now being built up as the new alternative president to replace President Maduro. Even if there was no attack on Venezuela last night, I don't think anybody seriously doubts that an attack is coming. And the Venezuelans themselves have taken such action as they can in response. They have deployed troops with surface-to-air missiles, man-pad missiles, so far as I can see. Venezuela has also deployed some of the Suhoi 30 fighter jets that Hugo Chavez bought from Russia. Oof, must have been more than a decade ago now. Some of these do carry apparently anti-ship missiles, and they are powerful fighter jets and powerful missiles. I have to say straight away that from what I have heard, Venezuela's total force of Suhoi 30 fighter jets is around 20. A formidable air force by Latin American standards, but hardly, in my opinion, comparable to what the United States can deploy if it decides to conduct an air campaign against Venezuela. And beyond that, I further understand that there are doubts about the serviceability of some of these fighter jets. It could be that the number of Suhoi 30s that Venezuela can put into the air is less than some of the reports are suggesting. There have been reports over the last couple of days about flights of Ilyushin transport planes from Russia to Venezuela, and there's also been reports of flights of Chinese aircraft to Venezuela as well. It is possible that the Russians have provided spare parts and assistance to refurbish some of these aircraft. It's possible that the Chinese and the Russians have provided the Venezuelans with more advanced air-to-air missiles. Who knows? But again, it does seem to me that if we're talking about an overall conflict between Venezuela and the United States, then the odds lopsidedly are in America's favor. They must be. And unlike Ukraine, which has secure and stable supply lines to its Western backers, it can receive equipment securely through the transport and road links that come from Europe. Ukraine, after all, borders the NATO, borders NATO. Venezuela is located oceans away from its key allies, its key friends and allies, Russia and China, and that must inevitably limit the amount of support that they can give. The one thing I would say is that in the face of this crisis, there'd be no reports of protests that I'm aware of in Venezuela against the Maduro government. There's been no sign so far of dissent by the army. It could be that people are waiting to see if the American attack happens, but it suggests that there is not a huge amount of support, to put it mildly, in Venezuela for an attack by the United States. And, well, some people have talked about a rallying around the flag effect on the part of the Venezuelan population. Well, we'll just have to wait and see. It remains a huge country, very difficult to control. US ground forces in the area are few. Unless the United States can find allies on the ground, I can certainly see all sorts of challenges. And of course, if there is an uplift of patriotic emotions on the part of the people of Venezuela, then it's not impossible that this could all end in a debacle. I am being very careful about what I say here, straightforwardly because I don't know the situation in Venezuela at all well. I have not been there, and I don't know, I'm not at all sure how things will play out. What I will say again is that if there is an American attack on Venezuela and the Maduro government withstands it and survives, then over time, the balance will shift, to some extent at least, in the Maduro government's favour, and the United States will be confronted by all sorts of problems and challenges, which I have no idea how it intends to address. So that is what I want to say about this conflict. There is a further thing that needs to be said. The United Nations Secretary General has apparently, Mr. Guterres, has apparently said quite openly that an attack on Venezuela would be contrary to international law. This is the universal consensus amongst lawyers. I believe that even if Venezuela really were infiltrated and controlled by criminal networks in the way that the United States is alleging, that would still be true, just say. I know that there are protests within sections of the US military already about the attacks on the speedboats that have been taking place, and I believe an American admiral has basically resigned over them. I might be wrong about that. But anyway, going back to the blatant illegality of this enterprise, the fact that it would undoubtedly, as far as I can see, amount to aggression. Nobody is alleging that Venezuela is or poses any sort of military threat to the United States. An attack on Venezuela, especially an attack which fails, would have absolutely disastrous consequences. It would further damage not just the reputation of the United States, that's already shot to pieces, in my opinion, but, well, its credibility. And how would the United States be able to continue to claim that the Russian operation in Ukraine constitutes aggression, for example, or that a future Chinese operation against Taiwan would constitute aggression in light of what the United States seems that it is going to do against Venezuela? Now, what makes this even more extraordinary is that the United States apparently attempted to negotiate with the government of Venezuela. President Trump sent an envoy to Venezuela, Rick Grenell, a person very close to Donald Trump, who was for a time acting director of national intelligence during his first term. And, Rick Grenell has had meetings with Venezuelan officials, including President Maduro. And apparently President Maduro was prepared to concede to Mr. Grenell on pretty much everything: American control of the oil industry, American control of all sorts of things within Venezuela. The United States does not need to attack Venezuela in order to gain control of its oil industry. If that is the purpose behind all of this, it can have it anyway through agreement with the current government. Apparently, what caused the United States, the administration, to engage instead on this massive build-up and military operation is some strange animus against the personality of President Maduro himself. Given the reputational damage and the risk, which the extent of which I cannot assess, of a debacle if things go wrong, allowing personal feelings to govern policy in that kind of way when the United States can have everything it wants through agreement with the existing government. Seems to me absolutely baffling. But again, it's fully consistent with the way in which the United States has approached its foreign policy, which led to the debacles with Russia and China, which we saw last week. Now, lastly, I'm going to say this: an attack on any country is an incredible act of violence. It will be an act of violence against the people of Venezuela. People are going to die. I can't imagine that the outcome in the end is going to be good, even if the Maduro government is replaced and a Machado government is established. That government inevitably is going to have questions of illegitimacy hanging over it, in which case Venezuela could be looking at years, maybe decades, of instability and potential violence. If this is about the best interests of the people of Venezuela, and I don't believe anybody thinks that, actually, I certainly don't. Well, all I can say about that is that that is a profoundly wrong and entirely mistaken view. The people of Venezuela will absolutely not welcome, or will not benefit, I should say, from an attack on their country. The liberated people of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria can all vouch to that. Since I'm on the topic of Syria, just to say very briefly that following the very friendly meeting that took place between President Putin of Russia and the acting president of Syria, al-Sharaa, the man I will always think of as Jalani, the former jihadi leader, who should turn up in Moscow but al-Sharaa's defense minister. He's had multiple days of discussions with the Russians. He's met Belousov, the defense minister. He's met all kinds of Russian military officials. The new Syrian government seems to be tilting very heavily towards Moscow at the moment. So if this is all some great big geopolitical play to oust Assad and to try to pull Syria away from Russia, well, the geopolitics of that particular enterprise don't seem to have been working at all well, to put it mildly. Anyway, let's now go back to the other conflict, the big conflict that's taking place today, where I'm going to say straightforwardly, after the events of the last couple of months, the last week especially, it seems to me that the United States now, and the Trump administration specifically, now is threatened by another massive, perhaps fatal for its reputation, foreign policy debacle. The first thing to say is that President Zelensky appears to be overwhelmed by the bad news on the battlefronts and in the sky, and he is retreating now firmly into the world of delusion. He held a meeting in Moscow. Kiev, not in Moscow, obviously. He held a meeting in Kiev with various top officials I noticed that one particular official prominently stayed away, and that is the military intelligence chief, Kirill Budanov. Now, this is truly remarkable because Budanov used to be thought of as an extreme hardliner in Ukraine, a person who wanted to keep the war with the Russians going and was determined to fight the Russians to the bitterest end, and somebody who spoke ultimately about achieving victory against the Russians. He is also seen as something of a national hero by many people in Ukraine. Over the course of the last year, as the realities that Ukraine is facing on the battlefronts, in the sky, in economics have gradually closed in, Budanov has become increasingly critical and has spoken out increasingly against the folly of the policy line that Zelensky and Yermak and Syrsky and the others are following. And there's been repeated reports that Zelensky and Yermak have been trying to dismiss him. He manages to stay in post, apparently, because there are still people in the CIA who support him, though I wonder for how long, by the way. But anyway, whatever, Budanov chose to stay away from this absolutely extraordinary, truly bizarre, fantastic meeting. And well, Budanov's chief rival, Malyuk, the head of the SBU, was there, and Zelensky and Malyuk made all sorts of truly incredible claims. So Zelensky said that the Russian forces that are trying to capture Pokrovsk number 170,000 men. Previously, the Ukrainians had said that it was 110,000, but now another 60,000 have been added. I actually saw a report a couple of days ago that the true number of Russian forces that are there around Pokrovsk is around 27,500 Russian forces. And that, I have to say, seems to me a far closer approximation to the true number. But anyway, so he started there. Zelensky insisted that the Ukrainians are gaining ground in Pokrovsk, that all talk of the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk being encircled was all lies. He said that Ukraine has won the Battle of Kupiansk. Again, I know of no one who would say that, but that's what he said. He said that Putin wants to visit Pokrovsk himself, but if he goes to Pokrovsk, he will be killed by the Ukrainians. I've never heard Putin say anything about intending to visit Pokrovsk. I suspect that Zelensky has got this idea from Putin's recent visit to the headquarters, the Ukrainian headquarters, where the operations against, the Russian headquarters, sorry, where the Russian operations in Pokrovsk are being organized, and where he met with the local commanders, and where he received the briefing from the chief of the general staff and commander of the Russian forces in the special military operation, General Gerasimov, which I've discussed in many recent programs. For the record, I believe that meeting took place in the town of Selidovo, which the Russians captured a year ago. Anyway, there we go. Perhaps Zelensky got that idea that Putin has some desperate need to visit Pokrovsk. Indeed, I can't explain or imagine. But anyway, that is what Zelensky said. Malyuk, his intelligence chief, was there and apparently supporting him in all of these claims, including in an even more bizarre claim that Ukraine somehow sent some special forces unit to Kapustin Yar, the tremendous, the huge Russian cosmodrome and test center east of Volgograd in the area of Astrakhan, the place where the Oreshnik missiles are tested, and as well as many other missiles are tested, and that they managed to destroy on the ground a missile system, an unknown missile system. This is in 2023, which it is now established was in fact the Oreshnik, an early version, a prototype version of the Oreshnik. If that were true, surely the Ukrainians would have said as much then, and surely they would have been talking about it ever since. I cannot recall the Ukrainians ever saying this before. Anyway, Zelensky and Malyuk also claimed that since the start of the year, Ukraine has destroyed 48% of Russia's Pantsir point defense combined gun missile systems. They have supposedly successfully depleted Russia's air defense system altogether, so that Russia cannot keep up, its production rates cannot keep up with the number of missiles lost. Well, you know, I don't know what the number of missiles the Russians launch, air defense missiles the Russians launch actually is, and I don't know the number of such missiles that the Russians produce. So that is one claim, by the way, I can't refute, but I'm going to say straight away that I don't believe it. Anyway, we've had a whole succession of truly fantastic, bizarre claims. And Zelensky again repeated that Ukraine is intending to conduct huge drone attacks and missile attacks deep inside Russia. Well, we're now being told that it is going to be the Flamingo missile, that is going to, the Ukrainian Flamingo missile, that is going to be the principal weapon that the Ukrainians are going to use in this missile offensive against the Russians. Not the Tomahawk at all. And the Flamingo supposedly is a better missile than the Tomahawk. It has a much bigger warhead and a longer range. That the Ukrainians have not been able to produce them in quantity is perhaps a problem, but never mind, eventually they will be produced. The Ukrainians say that they have actually launched some of these missiles already. So they've already deployed the Flamingo missile against the Russians. Apparently 9 missiles have been launched in total. I wonder whether that report that the Ukrainian General Staff made 2 or 3 weeks ago about a Ukrainian cruise missile strike on the chemical factory in the Russian city of Bryansk, which the Ukrainians at that time were saying was carried out with Storm Shadow missiles, was actually a strike with Flamingo missiles. Just saying, it would make more sense. The Russians on that day said that they shot down 4 cruise missiles. They didn't identify which they were. They could have been Storm Shadows, but of course they might also have been Flamingo missiles. For the record, I have still not seen, personally, any satellite imagery that shows the Bryansk factory as having suffered any damage. Just saying. Anyway, Ukrainian claims about the Flamingo missile would have been assisted, were it not, would have been more credible, maybe, were it not the fact that the Ukrainians have now published a film about the Flamingo missile, which I will say straight away that I have not myself seen, but which apparently contains footage lifted from the British feature film Operation Crossbow, which was made in 1965 and which relates to the V1, the German V1 and V2 program, and which apparently also shows launches not of Flamingo missiles but of American Tomahawk missiles, which by the way are quite different. Anyway, I haven't watched this film, so perhaps I shouldn't say too much. But anyway, the overall impression left from this truly bizarre meeting is of Zelensky himself retreating into the world of fantasy, unable any longer to come to grips, to come to terms with the reality of the situation on the ground, and living in his own fantasy land, into which he appears to have managed to suck various other people into as well. And this has been reinforced by a truly bizarre episode that took place last night, about which both the Ukrainians and the Russians have provided accounts. Now, we started with a Ukrainian report about a successful special forces operation involving members of Ukrainian military intelligence. By the way, that is Budanov's outfit. Anyway, this operation supposedly took place in Pokrovsk. The Ukrainians successfully landed a American Black Hawk helicopter, apparently within the Pokrovsk territory, in territory that the Russians supposedly had captured, on fields that the Russians had supposedly captured. A commando unit of special forces was landed. It carried out, allegedly, a successful attack against the Russians. And the Ukrainians published footage of the landing of the helicopter on this field and of 10 special forces commandos exiting the helicopter and conducting an attack of some kind. Well, the Russians then provided their own footage, which basically took us from the point where these commandos exited the helicopter, and it showed all of the commandos, every single one, all 10 of them, being attacked and killed or wounded or at any rate put out of action as a result of an immediate hail of Russian FPV drones. Now, this all happened at night, so this is further example of how Russian FPV drones nowadays have carry night vision devices. So that is the Russian account that all of these soldiers were killed. I believe it to be true, though it is not perhaps entirely impossible that the Russians have staged some of this, but then I don't know how. I nonetheless overall believe this Russian account. I have no reason not to. I have seen no word that the Ukrainian commandos actually achieved anything. And for the further record, it seems that various mapping projects and all kinds of people who are good at these sort of things did geolocation of the place, the field where this helicopter landed, and identified it as this whole episode is happening not within the territory of the Pokrovsk cauldron, but in a field located north of it, a field which the Russians have never claimed to have captured, and which no Russian, no mapping project, Russian or otherwise, shows as being under Russian control. There is some suggestion that this was a real operation. I said in my program yesterday that the Russians do now appear to be advancing north of Pokrovsk. They seem to be intent on conducting some kind of attack on the village of Grishino, which is located to the west of Pokrovsk, and which appears to be the principal base area for Ukrainian forces that have been launching attacks on the Russian positions around Pokrovsk in order to achieve some kind of a breakthrough to break the cauldron that's now developed around Pokrovsk. It could be that this special forces raid was in some way connected to these battles. But if so, all the indications are that the operation was completely unsuccessful and that it failed. Now, I would say that I've seen some reports that there was not just one helicopter, one Black Hawk helicopter used, but two, and that one of these helicopters was destroyed. I'm not absolutely sure that this is the case, and I haven't seen footage of it having actually been destroyed, but it may be that this was true. There's other reports that the Russians have captured some commandos, Ukrainian commandos. I don't believe those reports, but who knows? Anyway, whatever, it looks as if this event was something of a debacle as a military operation. But we could see how the Ukrainians nonetheless attempted to make use of it and of the James Bond quality one finds about it in order again to foster this story that the situation in Pokrovsk continues to be in some way under control and to the advantage of the Ukrainians. I would say that the Russians have released drone footage of their own, and this appears to come from the Rubicon group. And, well, the drone footage, which I only briefly saw, I found it too upsetting to continue with, is harrowing. It appears to have been made in an area north of Pokrovsk, in the area where the one small stretch which is not actually occupied by the Russian military and which in theory would still be an escape route for the Ukrainian troops trapped inside Pokrovsk. And what it shows is Ukrainian soldiers trying under cover of night to try to escape through this small stretch of territory. It's about 1 kilometre wide, some say 2 kilometres wide, and being tracked and hunted down and killed by the Russian drones, the Rubicon group's drones. And as I said, it is deeply upsetting. It suggests that some Ukrainian soldiers are indeed trying to escape the encirclement in Pokrovsk, but that they are not able to do so, and they are paying a terrible price as a result. Lastly, I would quickly add that within Ukrainian social media, there is a set of comments circulating, which is attributed to a military commander, a Ukrainian military commander, with forces either in or close to Pokrovsk. He says that all of the areas that are marked by DS, the Ukrainian mapping project, in the Pokrovsk area as being in the grey zone, in other words, contested, are actually under complete Russian control. The Russians control at least 60% of Pokrovsk, and that the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk are indeed encircled. And apparently, there are reports that a Ukrainian drone operator who has managed to exit Pokrovsk in some way, maybe he was one of the people who did manage to get through. Apparently, he is saying the same thing. Anyway, the reality, I have no doubt, is that Pokrovsk is indeed surrounded. It looks as if the Ukrainian attacks or counterattacks northeast of Pokrovsk have been unsuccessful. That Radovka's description of the failures of these counterattacks again has turned out to be true. And the trap around Pokrovsk continues to tighten. The Russians continue to make more ground, gain more ground in Pokrovsk. The size of the cauldron continues to shrink, and the battle there continues to go very badly. There are other reports, by the way, that originate from the Russian side, which say that the Russians actually now control 80% of Pokrovsk. And I would have said, based on what I've seen from the maps, that that is probably likely to be true. And my guess is that the Russians also now are in effective control of much the greater part of Mirnograd, though I'm not going to make guesses as to precisely what proportion of Mirnograd that they do control. Anyway, it is a terrible picture, and Zelensky's observations, well, if the soldiers, the Ukrainian soldiers in Pokrovsk have heard them, I just wonder what they make of them and how angry they must feel. The same is true about Kupiansk. Zelensky claims that the Battle of Kupiansk has been won. I cannot for the life of me see how. All of the reports speak of the Russians, the latest reports speak of the Russians extending their control south of the Oskol River. There were reports yesterday that the Ukrainians have rushed reinforcements to this area, perhaps to hold the Russians back, perhaps to try to push the Russians back in places in order to make it easier for Ukrainian troops in the Pokrovsk area, in the Kupiansk area, to escape the cauldron that has been created. As I said, I'm not going to speculate exactly what is happening in Kupiansk, but all of the indications there are that the situation is getting worse and worse. And, well, a Russian military expert, Vitaly Kiselyov, has now provided some account of the fighting, specifically in Pokrovsk this time, not Kupiansk. He says that even today, the Ukrainians are not building new fortifications in Pokrovsk for the further retreat of their troops, a tactical escape to the rear. And he says, I think they will now start forcing civilians from their private residential properties, threatening and maybe even, well, coercing them to occupy their houses and auxiliary facilities as basements, turning the entire residential property into a fortified area. Well, that's what Kiselyov says. But basically, there are no proper defence lines being created. And he said that the situation, there was not enough time to create proper fortifications. The opportunity to do this in Pokrovsk has gone. And that Zelensky and his officials lied about the true extent of the fortifications in Pokrovsk in their reports, as Kiselyov says, to Brussels. And about that, I suspect he's absolutely right. Now, there are things going on other parts of the battlefields, and they are also very important. So if we go to Zaporozhye region, there are now reports confirmed this time by the Ukrainians that the Russians have entered Uspenivka, the village on the Yanchur River. That is the last important position that the Russians have to capture before they can continue their advance to cut the supply lines to Gulyapolye. It is probably only days before Uspenivka falls. If the Ukrainians try to resist there, they will be trapped in Uspenivka as well, just as the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk and in Kupiansk are trapped. The Russians have now undoubtedly entered Novopavlovka, the small town, but heavily fortified town, in Dnipropetrovsk region, and fighting is indeed taking place there. But it seems again that Ukrainian resistance is disorganized and weak, just as Kiselyov said it was in Pokrovsk. And, well, it's expected that this important fortified position is going to fall to the Russians, perhaps in a week's time, opening the way for the Russians to advance deeper into Dnipropetrovsk region, possibly all the way to the city of Pavlograd. And of course, beyond Pavlograd is the Dnieper and the city of Dnipro itself. There are now further claims about the situation in Kherson region. More reports of the Russians expanding their control of the islands in the Dnieper River close to the city of Kherson. And there continue to be very sketchy but very difficult to understand claims that the Russians do hold positions on the west bank of the river of the Dnieper in Kherson city itself. Again, there is there's a complete absence of video footage and a total blackout of commentary about this from the Russians. But I continue to believe that some kind of operation is underway here, and that operation appears to be in progress. And again, I get the sense that Ukrainian resistance in Kherson city is sporadic and largely, well, apparently unable to push the Russians back beyond the Dnieper again. And reports continue to circulate that the Russians are now fighting deep inside Konstantinovka, the big town located to the east of Pokrovsk, though it is universally agreed that Pokrovsk itself, that Konstantinovka itself, will only fall after Pokrovsk is done, that the Russians will need to capture Pokrovsk in order to encircle Konstantinovka. But that is definitely going to happen at some point over the next few weeks. And also, there are lots of reports now, and there are so many again that it's difficult to argue against them and against the detail that some of these reports are providing, that the Russians now have established strong positions in the town of Liman to the west, to the east of Slavyansk, and that fighting there is also taking place, and that an operation to storm Liman, the town of Liman, is underway. Liman, a town the Russians captured in May of 2022, that they then lost to the Ukrainians during Ukraine's counteroffensive in October 2022, but which it seems the Russians are in the process of capturing, of regaining control of again. And as has been pointed out by various people, Brian Beletic, for example, but also Radovka, if the Russians are able to capture Liman and the neighboring town of Sviatogorsk, well, not neighboring, but the nearby town of Sviatogorsk, then the Russian drone operators can operate fiber optic drones far enough, apparently, to be able to start blocking the supply roads leading to Slavyansk, starting to close down the supply roads, the stranglehold, the choking, if you like, of supplies to the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk conurbation can then begin. Well, a crisis on every front lines, and I didn't mention Siversk, which, as I said, also now looks to be on the brink of being surrounded and placed in a cauldron as well. The accumulation of bad news is so bad, as I said, that Zelensky himself seems to be losing his ability to process it and to understand it. Last night, Ukraine conducted what appears to have been its biggest drone attack against Western Russia of the war up to now. Supposedly, up to 700 drones were used in total. Zelensky, again, over the course of that bizarre meeting, spoke about Ukraine conducting a further offensive with drones and missiles against Russia. Moscow seems to have been targeted specifically with these drones. From what I can tell, the Russians were able to shoot down far and away the greater number of them. It may be that some got through. There are some reports that a micro district of Moscow, Lubetsi, might have experienced a brief power outage or a power outage of some kind. I don't know. But I've heard no information of any serious cutoff in power in Moscow itself, or by the way, anywhere else in Western Russia. The drones, the Ukrainian drones, are too small by themselves, and the warheads they carry are too light to do any significant damage to Russian power facilities. It's the same with the refineries. This story has been massively talked up. A huge amount of effort and energy has been wasted by Ukraine on this drone and missile offensive, but it can never achieve anything remotely approximating to the results that Zelensky and some of his officials claim, and which the media in the West has been claiming as well. Anyway, there it is. It seems as if Zelensky himself, at some point in the summer, began to buy in to some of his own propaganda. I said that it seemed to me, I've said several times that it seemed to me that sometime around the summer, the mid or early summer, perhaps after the failure in Kursk region, or more probably after the Russians started to make inroads around Konstantinovka and Pokrovsk and started to break through in Zaporozhye and Dnipro regions, I said then that it seemed to me that this was the moment when Ukrainian leaders began to accept that they were going to lose the war. Budanov, the military intelligence chief, came to that view some months earlier, as he made clear in a meeting to the Ukrainian parliament, the Rada. But it seemed to me there were indications from various comments that the Ukrainian leadership was making that they seemed to have grasped sometime around midsummer that Ukraine was going to lose the war. What they then did, however, was rather than engage the Russians in negotiations, is that they began to tell the West a completely different story, that they had the Russians where they wanted them, that the Russians weren't able to break through. They invented the fantasy of the drone wall through which supposedly the Russians would be unable to advance. They made all kinds of fantastic claims about how the Russians were suffering staggering casualties for minimal gains. And they, at some point, persuaded General Kellogg and General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and perhaps the CIA, that in fact they were able to hold out, and that all that they needed, therefore, was long-range missiles and tougher sanctions on the Russians and more support, and that all, nonetheless, would be well. And it seems to me that at some point over the next couple of weeks, some people, Zelensky specifically, might have started to believe their own propaganda. The reality is that throughout this time, throughout the summer, Ukraine's situation has steadily deteriorated. Steadily, and in my opinion, actually, rapidly deteriorated. Again, I know that this is contrary to the accepted wisdom that Russian progress has been slow. If you see this instead, as I do, as a war of attrition, then it seems to me that the effect of attrition has been becoming more and more apparent, and in Zaporozhye region especially, the Russian advances have been anything but slow. And in Pokrovsk especially, since August, it's been impossible to describe the situation there as unfolding at all slowly. But anyway, the Ukrainians pretended otherwise. They told everybody that they had things under control. They started to believe these fairy tales themselves. They talked themselves into thinking that the Sapsan missile, of which we see no sign, by the way, and the Flamingo missile would be able to change things. And they also tell themselves that the Taurus missiles and the Tomahawk missiles were coming. And they believed that by bringing the war to the Russians, to the Russian people in that way, that would entirely change the calculus of the entire battle. And well, suddenly, over the last couple of days, they have been confronted by the reality, the actual reality on their battle, on the battlefronts. Not just that they have thousands of men surrounded in Kupiansk and Pokrovsk, and that they are going to lose Liman and Siversk before very long, but that the entire fortified position in Donbass, which is the linchpin of their entire defense, is crumbling, that their army is withering away, and that the funding from the West is no longer coming in anything like the quantities that it did previously, and that the Western powers themselves have acknowledged that they're starting to run out of funds to support Ukraine, and that the alternative, the 140 billion euro loan secured against the Russian assets, faces legal challenges and perhaps political challenges, which may in the end be insuperable despite the political will that exists among some politicians in the West. Anyway, I don't believe that any of this is going to change Zelensky's approach to the war. Even if Donbass is lost, even if the Russians capture the whole of Zaporozhye region and capture Kherson region and advance to the Dnieper, even if they cross the Dnieper in central Ukraine, I believe that the political structures which exist in Kiev and which have now been constructed around Zelensky himself will survive all of those blows, and that Zelensky will still refuse any substantive concessions and will refuse to make peace. But this fantastic meeting that has just taken place in Kiev shows that despite all of the bluster, despite the hysteria and all of the rest, even Zelensky himself is now starting to realize that the writing is on the wall. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. More from me soon. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, and X. Please also remember to check out our new Substack page, where we publish our videos, and where, by the way, I also write articles. And we'll be submitting another article fairly shortly. And last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if you've liked this video. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.